The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Hello and welcome to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles and podcasts. That's premierunbelievable.com. But now for today's show. We are diving into the Unbelievable Archives. The programme that you're about to hear was originally broadcast in October 2010. Justin Briley was joined by Lewis scholar Dr. Michael Ward and former Christian turned atheist Dan Barker. Here they reflect on the faith, philosophy and apologetics of C.S. Lewis. Let's join them for the second part of their discussion.
I suppose the point is, at some level though, Michael, Lewis recognised that he couldn't account for his own wish for the way the world is or the way he found the world. He could only account for that if there was, if you like, a presence underlying it, which kind of gave the foundation for moral beliefs and for, and even for reason itself.
Yes, well, yeah, let's maybe talk a little bit more about his understanding of reason itself, that he thought that one couldn't really defend the idea of reason on atheistical principles, because, again, if all that there is in this universe at a fundamental level is the clashing of atoms, you know, admittedly very sophisticated arrangements of atoms in the case of human beings, but if that is fundamentally the nature of our being, then how is it that we would wish to ascribe this metaphysical thing called truth to the ideas that we have in our brains?
I mean, this is something he develops, and this was a big thing for me when I read, sort of in my late teens, his book Miracles, which is somewhat misleading in its title because half of it is about miracles and the miracles you see Jesus doing, but the other half is actually a kind of quite a detailed sort of framework for this argument for God from reason.
Yeah. That's because he regards rational thought as a miracle of a sort, that in every rational, reasonable human thinker, you have this mini miracle of rationality, that it's not just cerebral biochemistry, it's not just the movement of the grey matter in our brains when our minds are thinking truly, it's actually what he calls a participation in a cosmic spirit of rationality, a cosmic logos that he describes.
I mean, can I just read another small quote from Miracles, which kind of, I think, sums up in a sense where he was coming from on this. He says, "If naturalism is true, we have no reason to trust our conviction that nature is uniform. It can only be trusted if quite a different metaphysic is true, if the deepest thing in reality, the fact which is the source of all other facthood, is a thing in some degree like ourselves, if it is a rational spirit, and we derived our rational spirituality from it, then indeed our conviction can be trusted." I mean, it's an argument that's been developed since he proposed it by people like Alvin Plantinger, and we're going to be having him on the show in a couple of weeks' time as well, talking about the kind of defeater of naturalism as far as he sees it in evolution, which is how, if evolution is the way by which we suppose we've come to have rational faculties, well, what sort of on what basis do we say we are therefore we can trust our rational faculties in what is essentially a blind purposeless kind of process, only if there is a God who, if you like, grants a basis on which we can trust our rational faculties, can we even start to talk about that we've got this right,
can we even begin to talk about the insights of science? And Dan was just talking about the developments in science over the last 50 years, but why is it that we should even trust science if we can't trust our own minds to give us insight into reality? And how could our minds give us insights into reality if they were just physical entities? That's one of Lewis's main points in Miracles, that rational thought is of a different order from our other bodily functions. It's qualitatively different from, say, a cough or a sneeze or our other bodily secretions. We actually think of our mental capacities, our insights into reality, as giving us this thing called truth. We are related to things truthfully or falsely. We're not just related to them spatially.
So again, it's a kind of a metaphysical concept which has is crying out for an explanation of some kind, which a purely naturalistic materialist universe doesn't seem to give. Dan, you've been listening to this. What's your initial response to this so-called argument from reason for God?
Yeah, well, the naturalistic, materialistic worldview does give a very satisfactory explanation for reason. Reason and thought are not qualitatively different from the functioning of any other organ. They are quantitatively different. They are at a more complex level, but there's nothing in the human brain that is qualitatively different from the molecules within the stomach that causes digestion to happen, another organ which is functioning in a certain way for our survival. Truth is not a thing. Michael talks about truth as if it were something that we perceive or find, as if it were a thing. Truth is simply a label for those statements or propositions that we might make that either correspond or don't correspond to reality as we see it. No scientist takes the uniformity of nature as somehow a unbreakable law. It's possible. Every scientist is open to miracles. Every scientist is open to the possibility that we simply haven't waited long enough to know. But in the meantime, we have no choice but to assume that since the world is uniform today and is working according to these. We use the word law, and that word law is very ambiguous because it sometimes can assume a lawgiver. But in science, that's not what a law is. There's a difference between descriptive laws and prescriptive laws. But in science, a law is a rule that over many, many observations, we expect and predict that those observations will continue. We don't say they have to, but it's a rule that is in place that has served us very well. Science is not a dogma or a creed. So C.S. Lewis has fallen into this trap, and it's not just theists who make this trap, but this trap of somehow, he's a dualist, basically. He thinks mind is somehow qualitatively different from the natural world, when in fact we can show through science the beauty. In fact, I think it's even more awe-inspiring than some super being up there with desires and wants and petty grievances who created us for his own loneliness or whatever it was. We can see how, from simplicity, complexity can arise, not the other way around. The theistic answer assumes that complexity arises from more complexity, which answers nothing, because what is God made of? Isn't God made of some kind of spiritual atoms that are bouncing around inside of him, too? Doesn't God have some standard of right and wrong for his own mind? Isn't this God supposed, you know, what is his sense of the numinous and the sublime? This is all backwards.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, I'm afraid, Dan, and we'll have Michael respond to those points in just a moment's time. Well, welcome back as we continue to look at the apologetics of C.S. Lewis, one of the most popular lay apologists probably in the world, and he continues to have a great appeal, especially in America. I mean, I know that you're in great demand, Michael, over in the States. There seems to be a real kind of C.S. Lewis movement around. people who almost, I have to say, almost idolize him in some ways. Do you think it's healthy, the kind of the amount of reverence that is given to Lewis and his works out in the States?
You're right. He is very much more popular in the States than he is over here. And on the whole, I think it's quite healthy. Yeah, it's partly, just to generalize grossly, it's partly, you know, the American temperament that if they like something, they are unashamed to be enthusiastic about it and to tell you. And, you know, there are lots of reasons, I think, behind the popularity of Lewis in the States.
I suppose the fact that there is such a large evangelical Christian contingent who obviously the appeal of his apologetics particularly is relevant in that situation. I think people also like the idea of an Oxford Don.
That's
and,
right.
And yeah. all the attraction that brings with
it. There is a strong Anglophile element in a lot of American culture. They like things that are British just because they're British, whereas we... the Brits, you know, it's no great shakes for us to be British.
And you must be almost the next best thing to C.S. Lewis, given that you were, I think you sort of looked after the kilns and the sort of the places where Lewis...
I lived in Lewis's house, the kilns, for 3 years as a kind of resident warden, sleeping in his bedroom and studying in his study. And and the Americans, many of the Americans that I interact with, you know, they can hardly conceive that this should be possible.
Did you feel his presence, Michael?
No. No, I didn't. No.
But coming back to what we were talking about before we went to a break, I mean, Dan there was kind of saying, no, look, you don't need to go to this extra level of thinking that there's some kind of immaterial sort of aspect to truth, to reason. It is just what our, you know, we're doing the best job we can with science, and the best, as far as we can see, science just tells us we are a brain, a material thing that kind of comes up with the best explanations for the world around us, and that's what we live with, that's what we do. We see, you know, nature has been uniform up till now, and we can, you know, rationally expect it to be uniform in the future. We can expect that the things we consider to be true really are true as best we can. Why do we need anything extra? Why was Lewis so keen to suggest that, you know, we don't have an ultimate foundation in some sense for our reason unless we invoke God?
Well, I think it comes back to this idea of what you consider to be truth. How is it that we trust our minds to give us this insight into reality? I mean, Dan talks about truth being no more than just a correspondence between our minds and reality, but why should we even think that there should be a reliable correspondence if the universe is just, you know, clashings of atoms at the ultimate level? When it comes to true thoughts, Lewis argues, we escape from the simple material naturalistic explanation of cause and effect to a new kind of relationship, which he calls the ground-consequent relationship. That when we understand something truly, it's not just because we have been, you know, shunted in a particular direction by a natural impulse. You know, it's not just like that we've caught some infection which is causing us to sneeze. It's not like we've just been thumped on the shoulder and therefore shifted slightly to the right. It's not a cause and effect in that sense. It's a ground and a consequent. We see grounds for rational belief, and the consequence of that perception is true belief. So an example that Lewis gives is, you know, to just try to clarify what he means between this difference between the ground-consequent relationship and the cause-effect relationship is, you know, you could say grandfather is ill today because he ate lobster last night. That's a cause and effect relationship. But you could also say grandfather has left the house because his hat is not hanging in the hall. And we know that he never goes out of the house without putting on his hat. Now, it's not the absence of his hat from the hat stand hasn't caused his absence from the house, but it is the grounds for our belief in his absence from the house. And that ability to see grounds and consequences is what Lewis calls this rational faculty, this ability to perceive truth.
And for him, that there's a big gap if all we are is, as you say, at an ultimate level, atoms banging into one another, albeit in very complex ways, we still can't get from that to a kind of ultimate trust that this is the way that rationality works, that you know.
Yes, it really is qualitatively different. It's mysterious. You know, it is hard to account for on naturalistic grounds, this ability to perceive truth. And scientists, I think, they slightly pretend that they don't believe in truth when really I think they do. And they get very cross with people who want to dispute the findings of science, because scientists believe that they have made correct deductions from their experiments and from their observations, and they call that truth. I mean, it might not be ultimate truth. There might be more to discover, and I'm very pleased to hear Dan say that no scientist disbelieves in the possibility of miracles. That's news to me. But scientists believe that what they've discovered is true.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. We were hearing there from Lewis scholar Dr. Michael Ward and former Christian turned atheist Dan Barker. They were speaking to Justin Briley on an unbelievable show, which was originally broadcast back in October 2010. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles and podcasts. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening and see you next time.